United Lutheran Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast, conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more, with voices from around the corner and around the globe. Welcome to the Seminary Explores. I'm Katie Giebenhain with Seminary Ridge Review. My guest is artist Brian Emery, a photography professor at Fashion Institute of Technology in New York. He is the current artist-in-residence at the Gettysburg National Military Park. Brian, welcome to the Seminary Explores.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So tell us about the project you're working on right now.
Unfortunately, as with most of my projects, it's a little, I overcomplicate things and it becomes a little difficult to describe. But to try to give a sense of what I'm doing, I'm creating a sort of experimental documentary. Mm-hmm. And I sort of call it that because it's a catch-all that I don't know that it fits perfectly. Exactly into any other category. But it is working with video and audio. And first I'll talk about the concept quickly and then mm-hmm. talk about the technique. So the concept is that I'm sort of trying to act a little bit like a sponge. I'm here for a month, so I'm trying to just record this video content, which I'll talk about in a moment, and audio recordings of everything I can. So that includes the environment, and certainly the battlefield is very, very important mm-hmm. to this. Audio of the environment, the birds here, I think are really important to the place. It's
true.
Like you can't go anywhere without hearing the birds, and I find that just magical and really important to the feeling of the place. And I'm interviewing people. I'm meeting as many different people from as many different kind of perspectives of the community as possible. And the goal is to try to create a documentary that's something about what it means to be a place. I'm really mm-hmm. interested in the idea of placeness. We can talk more about that a little bit later. But so this sort of experimental documentary is kind of trying to get at this idea of what the place of Gettysburg means. And to me, that has a lot to do with, you know, place has a lot to do with the folding of history over and over and mm-hmm. over again. So we mm-hmm. have all these different layers of history. And I kind of think that place in general is this sort of, you know, we have space and time, which are these sort of abstract concepts. And I think as humans, we take those abstract concepts and we make them real by applying narrative to space and time. So we end up with these locations that have stories attached to them. And that's what makes them place. And that's what makes them special to us. If it's uncharted territory, it's not really yet a place. It's this mm-hmm. sort of new frontier or something else that hasn't really yet been turned into a human kind of place. And so what I'm interested in is kind of trying to figure out ways to understand those folds of history and mm-hmm. Story and narrative. And then a big part of that is that very top layer of the fold, which is the now. And I think the now is the perspective through which we see all the other layers of history. So that perspective of which we're seeing history, I think, is constantly changing based on our contemporary context. I think. I'm not a historian, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. as an artist, this is my thesis, and I'm trying to work through different ways of figuring out if that's correct mm-hmm. or not, mm-hmm. I think. Now, the complicated part, if that wasn't already complicated, is in order to do this, I built this whole camera system that's mm-hmm. really sort of complicated, but goes very much to the idea I'm talking about looking through this top layer of the contemporary to this more historical past. Mm-hmm. So this camera that I built is it starts the front end of it. The lenses that actually see the world outside are a 1870s view camera. So it's okay. It's a stereoscopic view camera. So it's one of these cameras that has two lenses that are spaced about the same distance as a human's eyes are spaced apart.
Okay.
And it's the same kind of camera that Alexander Gardner and Matthew Brady and the Tyson brothers and all of the photographers that worked in the Civil War were working with stereo cameras. They also did 8x10 single plate, but that was much less lucrative.
Oh.
So they focused mm-hmm. mostly on the stereo views. And that was sort of the entertainment of the time. So my camera rig that I built starts with one of those cameras. Excuse me. But I've attached a digital camera to the back of it, a kind of typical prosumer D DSLR, but, you know, a good one, a professional one, but that allows me to record video through this stereo camera. So this stereo camera that was originally used to shoot still photographs in stereo or in 3D, it was the first 3D camera, essentially, I'm now using that as a sort of filter almost to filter my video through. And so what's sort of important about that in terms of the image is that because it's in quote-unquote stereo, there's actually two images on screen at all times, one from the right eye, as it were, the lens, and one from the left eye. And that can be turned into 3D. I might turn it into actual 3D, like where you need to wear the glasses. I might not. I might just work with the two images because there's something really magical about the way these two different images kind of touch each other. It's also upside down, which one you're looking at is confusing. I flip it back up in post-production, but I guess my point is that the experience of looking through the back of this whole weird camera system rig has allowed me to see composition in totally new and fresh ways. So part of it is using it as the old 3D technique, but also part of it is reinvestigating this kind of thing that I don't think anybody ever really thought about. Everybody always used this stereo camera simply to make a single 3D image. But when you really just look at the two images next to each other and how they, in video, how they start to kind of move in and out of each other, it creates these compositions that I never had really experienced before, and I was very, very excited to play with it. So it's kind of allowed me to work with all these new ideas and reinvestigate this old technique and work with this binary image, which I have a whole lot of other ideas about the contemporary age and binary and two sides of things and this and that and the other, but that's the sort of general gist of the project.
Well, I know this, the example that I saw a couple of days ago when you were on the square where you had the two, basically two reenactors, right? One from the north, one from the south. And at first there's just one, and then you see the second one. And so, like, you're not hearing anything, but they're both, they're engaged in a conversation with the person on the other side of the camera. And it really is, it's more powerful than you expect it to be, because there's this real matter of fact, like you can almost see two truths at the same time, and the conversation, and it, what it reminded me of is that example of how, you know, when we talk about storytelling and memory, and you can, like, if you're talking about, for example, a family Thanksgiving where there's 15 people in a room around a table, well, like, a week later, if you individually interview those 15 people about the conversation at that Thanksgiving, especially depending on how the conversation went, even though they're all trying to give you their viewpoint and they're trying to, they're like, well, I was there, this is what happened, right? And yet it's not identical.
Yeah.
And this was, you really can distill this binary thing. And I was thinking about that, about truth and storytelling and perception and our memories of history. And this also fits really nicely. And I had never thought about this folding image that you brought up. And also that we have, so the top, that's where we are. And sometimes we forget that we are making history too, that history isn't something in the past. And also people like to select a certain point, especially in this town. They'll talk about the history of the battle and they'll ignore what has happened in between. And that is history too, right?
Yeah.
And it can be kind of convenient to pick a certain point and just want to talk about that. But it's like, well, but how has that affected all the years?
Absolutely. Well, these are all the things I've been so fascinated about being here and trying to deal with. I mean, for instance, the LBGs, the Licensed Battlefield Guides, who were amazing. They're a part of the history of this place. Them, me going around in the car and them telling me the story of this place, that's another day. We could take a snapshot of that day that I did that and make a history of that day just as easily as we do July 2nd, 1863. There's not really a... There's nothing saying that those two days are any different, you know, in a certain sense. And so that's a big part of my my idea is being here, being a sponge. It's like I'm pulling all this stuff in from the now, and that's that is helping to also illuminate this layer, mm-hmm. this top layer that we do. I think I've been thinking. I never thought about history in my life until last year when I had a fellowship at Colonial Williamsburg, mm-hmm. and that started getting me to think about history as a more important thing that I'd never taken, really taken stock in. But I started having this kind of vision of you put those like the goggles on and you mm-hmm. put your head in the water and you see that it's like you're kind of ignoring the surface of the water and just getting down inside it and forgetting about all the wonderful stuff that's happening on the surface to see beneath it. And I think that's what we try to do. That almost sounds accusatory. I just think that's sort of the nature of how history works.
Sure.
I don't think it's not a critique. I just think it's the way we are as humans. And I think a lot of people talk about how the most difficult thing to experience is the present.
Sure.
We can think about the history and we can think about the future, but we love to ignore the present mm-hmm. in so many different ways,
I think that is human nature.
Yeah.
Definitely. And that's always going to be human
nature. Yeah.
So your training is in both photography and architecture. And how do you think that combination is interesting, the way that you're approaching this kind of project? I mean, the way you think about space and planning and or is it, am I assuming that it's influencing it more than it is?
Well, this is probably the most distanced from more clearly architectural lineage in my work that I've been.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by that is, my last project was done through a fellowship in Colonial Williamsburg, as I just mentioned. That was really focused on a specific attic of a house, a 1727 or 1729 house in Williamsburg that had a very, very fascinating story. So that was very architecturally driven, although I was looking at it as storytelling and I was using the architecture as a moment for storytelling or a platform or a stage for storytelling. So here, I don't really have exactly that direct connection to architecture per se, but what's led me from I studied architecture as an undergrad and worked briefly in architecture, but very briefly, before going to grad school and in photography and then teaching. And well, actually, when I went to New York, my first job was as a draftsman, so mm-hmm. I sort of went mm-hmm. back to it to make money for a minute. But my work previously was much more, and still is when I'm in New York, is much more about public space. And mm-hmm. it's about one of the things I became most interested in architecture is the space that's left over after the architecture is done, sort of becomes the public space in a city like New York, So it's really like anything that's not taken up by a building and doesn't have a fence, which is an architectural element of power or order or whatever you want to call it, anything that doesn't have one of those architectural features sort of becomes street or plaza or these sort of leftover spaces. And that's where I always was focusing, was in the sort of negative space of the city, the public space, because I'm really interested in how people interact and move. And I guess if I think it's that public space and the people that have led me a little bit to where I am now and working on these sort of what I'm calling experimental documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
I think I started to realize that instead of just photographing the space and photographing or videoing or whatever technique I'm using, the space and the way the people move through the space, I started kind of thinking maybe I should actually get to know these people, which is my greatest fear in the world, by the way. I'm an introvert. I mean, I'm like a serious mega introvert, and I just kind of started really trying to realize that actually what's interesting is the actual people and their stories, and they need to become a part of my work somehow. So in a way, I think that it's the architecture led me now to sort of people and storytelling and space in general. And then just, lastly, on top of that, on a more formal note, mm-hmm. I wouldn't be able to do the sort of formal compositions. I think photography and architecture go hand in hand. Mm-hmm. I can't tell you the number of people I've met who were architects and became photographers. And I think there is something about the two-dimensional, the sort of converging of three-dimensional space into a two-dimensional plane that architectural training really hones something about that ability. When photography is about space, a lot of people photograph, a lot of wonderful photographers aren't thinking about space. You know, it's not about space, but I think those of us who are dealing with photographing and imaging space, I think that the architectural background has something to do with being able to work cameras and create that space and all of these kinds of things. I will say one last quick thing is that the rig I built also, this camera, is it's a little bit of an architecture in and of itself. It's a little hard to explain without seeing it, but it's I had to build this whole box thing, and if I take the digital camera off the back, I end up with what looks like a little theater, a little stage, and you can peer into it and you can see the camera illuminated. You can see the back of the ground glass of the 1870s, the stereo camera, and it becomes a theater. And you can sort of put your eye in and look, and it really feels like this theatrical space because it's just a black box, which is sort of like the black box theater. So I think it pervades, or it invades the work in a lot of different ways. But I think really ultimately the most important thing is that it kind of led me to think about social issues and people and storytelling.
Well, the camera itself is a little built environment that's capturing these built environments and what's happening in them and the people in
them. Yes. Yes.
Wow. Is there anything about your experience so far, either on the battlefield or in town, because you're living on the battlefield, right? Is there? I know as a sponge, you said, you know, there's so much that you're seeing and hearing and absorbing each day. But is there something that you maybe didn't expect, or just something that has been even more, I don't know, has come across in a stronger way or a more unexpected way than maybe you thought?
Yes, I think so. A couple of things. First and foremost, everybody before I came out said, oh, I'd never been here. I'd never been to Gettysburg in my life. Everyone says, oh, as a kid, we did school trips. I'm like, I don't think I ever did a school trip here. I don't know. Everyone I told that I was coming here said, oh, it's beautiful. Oh, it's beautiful. And I said, oh, okay, it's beautiful. And then I got here, and I was like, oh, my gosh, it's beautiful. Like, it's really, you know, the sheer beauty of the landscape is, I mean, it just floored me. And I've been to very dramatic landscape. You know, I shoot a lot of landscape stuff. I work with the land, you know, I've done a lot of projects dealing with sort of landscape. But I'm really floored by this certain tranquil beauty that happened. Even with the amount of cars going by, which is funny because I'm right on Emmitsburg, you know, the Klingel House is right on Emmitsburg Road. So there's like constant car traffic. And that's even started to become like just a layer in the peacefulness and the tranquility of this kind of incredible place. So I that was, even though I was expecting it, that was sort of surprising. Then the other really fun thing that I just hadn't thought about is the relationship of storytelling to this whole place. And so almost every single person I've met here, pretty much all you have to do is make eye contact with them and they'll start telling you a story, you know, and it's just wonderful for someone who, like, that's what I like doing. I like hearing people tell stories and then try to make something out of those stories somehow. That's just been fascinating. And it's really, it's really sort of, it's just kind of amazing how much people like telling stories and how, I think just how ingrained the idea of storytelling and, you know, oral tradition and oral history is. And then I guess to take that further, there just is such a care for history. Mm-hmm. Everyone seems to feel like they're a little bit of a steward of the history of this place. And so I guess the really how involved people are with the place in general was just a surprising and kind of wonderful thing to find. So that's been great.
It's almost like a place where people also feel like they have permission to share stories, right?
Yeah.
So it's not only that they have the stories, but something about the space here gives people permission.
Absolutely. And I think that's a great point. I think, in fact, tourists come here to hear stories, which I didn't realize. Again, like I just, even though I knew that the car tour, I knew a little bit about all this stuff, but it just didn't really click until I was here. That you're right, it's absolute license. The last thing that really surprised me, and it comes up with license, it was the sort of license of the Confederate flag that's in this town that I find. I've spent time in other places in the South, and I've never felt quite the license, I think, in the use of the Confederate flag, which I understand because it becomes more symbolic here. Like, I think here there is a way in which, you know, it's constantly sort of crossed with the U.S. flag, so it's, I think there's an idea that it's acting purely symbolically or something. But that was surprising for me, because I just, other than sort of lone figures in their yard flying the flag or on their car with a sticker on their with the flag, it's rare that I've seen that, that I've seen it flown so much and stuff. So that's really interesting.
And there are a lot of mixed opinions about that here, as you can imagine. And even, for example, the seminary, we're very careful about, like, the Confederate flag is shown in the museum because that's considered an appropriate place depicting the battle, but you are not allowed to, on the seminary campus, have your, you know, the pickup truck with the flag and the T-shirts and that sort of thing, because, again, there is the history that has happened between now and the Civil War cannot be ignored, and that is a very... There is, you know, hate involved in that history. And so, but there's a difference, there's still a nuanced difference between, so like, there is a ban on these contemporary kind of uses, but it's not a complete ban because it's, you know, obviously in the museum, we have a scholar who directs the museum, and it's important to have that as part of the displays. But, and it's important to have it in, you know, we would have it in books in the library here too, but there is an enormous difference in context between what that means to our students and visitors and staff to have someone just displaying it in the way that they do now. And so there's, and the fact that some of the shops in Gettysburg, I mean, you can kind of see why they do, and yet that's also not... that there's not people are not of one mind. So this is a place where there are, you know, these tensions are felt and seen.
And that's part of what I want to dive into with this project. And I've been able to speak with a couple of people who are huge, you know, really believe that the flag is an important thing and is the, you know, a heritage and stuff. And I'm curious to hear more about that. It's something from New York. I don't really understand that point of view. So I'm curious to hear that. You know, it's the same thing I've been bringing up a lot with people. I'm interested in these dualistic issues. You know, I've been bringing up with a lot of people the monuments in South Carolina, which I think are, I'm sorry, in Louisiana, in New Orleans, which I think is an amazing conversation to have with people here, where the idea of a monument is so important, you know? So this is a great place, I think, to have that conversation with people. And it's been very interesting to find the, you know, what different people's ideas about that are. One of the things that's interesting is I've been noticing it continually comes down to, I hear a number of people say things, well, that's my history. And I'm really curious about that idea, about how is it possible as Americans that we could have a my history and a not my history? How is it not our history and stuff? So, but this all goes to the point that history is problematic inherently. And that's just worth investigating. It's not good or bad or other. It's just worth investigating, I think.
One of the things that... in a few conversations, when we obviously got a lot of blowback and we were attacked on Facebook, you know, the seminary was, because of the president making a statement like that. And when it comes to, you know, reminding people about these different folds of history, we had to say, Dylann Roof in South Carolina, technically he was a Lutheran. And this is a Lutheran seminary. So we are absolutely not, you know, that is part of history too. Mm-hmm. And just because someone here who happens to be a tourist from Louisiana or Mississippi and they have a certain, you know, aesthetic attachment to it or something like that, I think it's also important to say, well, this is your, does, is that more important than the present hurt that's causing? And it's interesting because I think there's a lot of things that, I mean, I can understand that first impulse, but then we really do need to look at some of the second impulses and say, all right, so that's how you feel about it. But there's also a difference between what you do like within your own house and when you're out, when we're, because history is public and mm-hmm. private, right? And when we're interacting with each other, how important it is, and how, and Americans have not done the best job of that. We've got a lot of denial about our history in so many different ways. Yeah. And anyway, so that it is fascinating to be in a town like this and to try to really understand where people are coming from, mm-hmm. and then to have conversations that are again not necessarily being critical, and yet also saying this is part of the information.
Yeah.
Like this is also part of history.
Yeah.
And it is and the pain that it causes some people, I think, is more important in many cases than just the feelings you might have for an ancestor that you never met.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's one last question that I have for you, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, but it's about arts funding. I mean, we're getting to broader issues here, but and I'm asking this, I'm curious about this, because you're a practicing artist yourself, and you're also a teacher at an art school. And so you are interacting, you're not only sort of training, but you're interacting with students who are going to be going into some sort of future in the arts. I mean, whether that's full-time or part-time, and depending on, you know, that could look a lot of different ways. And also we have a culture where right now federal arts funding is in danger. and sometimes, in the same way that we talk about history, when we talk, you know, art, that's just a huge word. And depending on people's personal experience with it, some people, you know, think it's more important than others. But it also has to do with public spaces, mm-hmm. and with the way the world is sort of shaped and seen and experienced.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just curious if you would be willing to share any sort of insights or feelings about what you observe as an artist and as a teacher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think art's been around longer than history. I mean, just to be honest, I mean, art, I'm really fascinated every time they find a new pebble that has a scratch in it from, you know, 80,000 years mm-hmm. ago or something crazy. You know, I mean, it's amazing. Like, we have been doing this since, I wish I was more of an expert in this, but since we were cognitively able to make that mark on something and see it as a human action, we've been doing it and we've found it important. And it's never died.
Hmm.
I mean, there's never a period when it's died. And we've gone through some periods, you know. And in fact, the harder the world gets to deal with, the better the art gets. That's something I don't love so much about art, is that, you know, but pain makes mm-hmm. tends to make better art, and struggle and these things. I think the funny thing, you started the conversation with funding, and I think the really funny thing about federal funding is that the NEA, which I think is amazing. First of all, it's tiny.
It is.
I mean, it's a fraction of nothing I heard that the security detail for Melania to stay in New York City costs more per year than the entire NEA funding. That needs to be fact checked.
Yeah.
But it's minuscule. And the thing that's really, unfortunately, amusing about the whole situation is that almost none of the money in NEA is going to like a New York City artist. The money for the NEA is more likely, what's the, is it the Majestic Theater here?
Yeah.
The NEA is more likely to fund the Majestic Theater than it is to fund one of my students, or me, for that matter.
Because they have access to other things.
They have access to other things in profession. But, you know, a small town in Texas that wants to have a gallery to show a local painter, or a local, you know, maybe there's a whole school of painting somewhere, they're going to be able to get a little bit of funding from the NEA to be able to make that happen.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like I think, you know, like so many other things, it's unfortunately the rural communities that are going to be hurt the most by if some of these things go away. Same with the National Endowment for the Humanities. I mean, I think they're funding the things that have a hard time otherwise getting funded.
Yeah.
So art's going to continue on no matter how much people try to trample on it. And we've had politicians try and trample on art in America for a long time. And it's always, you know, I mean, look at Mapplethorpe. Like, I mean, you know, he couldn't have become more of an important character after being trying to be censored and stifled by the government. So, you know, I think it's hugely important. I think it's going to keep going on no matter what happens and how trampled it gets. But I think the real danger is, you know, as a nation, or just as a people, as a politic, as a body politic, I wish, you know, Obama was a real champion for the arts, and he would comment on the arts. And so I think anybody who was listening and paying attention to him, and maybe it wasn't enough people, I mean, there was a lot of problems with the Obama administration, but, you know, if people were listening, then they got this message that the arts are important, and that's what I don't want to go away, is the idea that the arts are important. My biggest problem with students often is I get students sometimes who come in who don't come from families who believe art is important, and so they have to spend some of their energy almost convincing their family, which I had to do to a point. Not my parents, my family was never against me studying art, but they're not artists. So there's a certain idea of needing of education there. But some of my students, their families are really apprehensive about the idea of art, or just don't understand art or how art plays a role in their lives. And so it's really that the attitude that that I worry about. In New York City, we don't have to worry about it. I can tell you that. I mean, I live in Brooklyn, and I mean, it's like I wish there was half the... No, I don't really. I love how many artists there are, but it's just, you know, it's like we're so overwhelmed. New York City is an art and design city. It long has been. So we'll always be fine, but we need art in Gettysburg. We need art in, you know, Mississippi or wherever all, you know, in these more rural areas in other states, and not just New York, Chicago, L.A., Miami, so on and so forth.
Very good. Well, you've been listening to The Seminary Explores. I'm Katie Giebenhain with Seminary Ridge Review. My guest has been photographer Brian Emery. You can learn more about his work and see examples at his website. It's www.placecapetheater.com. That's PlaceScapeTheatre.com. theatre.com. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And all the best with the rest of your residency.
Thank you.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explores, a production of United Lutheran Seminary with campuses in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We invite you to visit our website at unitedlutheranseminary.edu. All opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of United Lutheran Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.